Hi, and welcome to Measure the Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Is that joke still funny?
It is. It's still funny. It has to be still funny because, you know, you're still a civil engineer. We're still married.
That's true.
Yeah.
They're all still facts.
I don't know if it's funny, but it's true. And it's funny because it's true.
That's right. Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument. Maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, why it is, where it is, who it is, why it is. I don't know. That joke is definitely not funny anymore. And it wasn't even supposed to be a joke. It's just a thing that I never remember where I started.
This is literally John's only scripted line. Besides the fact that he has to say he's married to me.
Yeah.
So that one's hard to forget. So today we're talking about the CN Tower.
Yeah.
Almost directly in our backyard, which we don't have one because we live in a condo in the downtown, but it is figuratively our backyard.
Yes, we have a wonderful view into other people's apartments. And some days when the sun shines just right off of their windows, you can see the reflection of the CN Tower.
Yeah, because it's directly behind us.
Yeah. We don't have one of the good apartments with a view of the tower. We have one of the, well, we have one of the comfortable apartments.
We have a view of our neighbors.
Yeah. We have a view of people who can see the CN Tower. So basically that's it.
So needless to say, the CN Tower is in Toronto, Canada.
Yes.
It is one of the tallest buildings in the world.
And it used to be the, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it used to be the tallest building structure.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. It was the tallest freestanding structure until 2007, when it was surpassed by the Burj Khalifa in Dubai.
Okay. Which is not a tower.
No, it's a skyscraper. So I guess even after that was built, the CN Tower was still technically the tallest tower until 2009, when it was surpassed by the Canton Tower in Guangzhou.
So.
Yep. Still pretty dang tall.
Yeah, it's big. Although I do have to say, one of the things that like bugs me about the CN Tower is like a lot of the height is just a lightning rod. You know, it's like you look at it and it's like kind of the big part of the CN Tower is barely more than halfway up. And then there's just this skinny little, I don't know, I think it's kind of cheap. Like,
so I'm going to go into that, but it's not just a lightning tower.
I think it's just a lightning
rod. It's not just a lightning rod.
It's one of those things. It's like the equivalent of wearing platform shoes and saying that you're the tallest person in the world, you know?
No, I think it's more like building your hair up really high to like a mohawk.
Putting on a really big, tall hat and platform shoes and then counting that in your height. Anyhow, I have a bit of a thing.
It is very tall. It was constructed in 1976 was when it was opened.
Mm-hmm.
Started in 1973, so it took about 3 years to construct.
Yeah.
It cost $63 million Canadian dollars at the time.
Okay.
Which translates to roughly $350 million Canadian dollars today.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, the Canadian dollar was quite low compared. So, I mean, if the Americans had wanted to come up and build a tower, they could have done it for like $40 million.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. So.
I don't know why the Americans would come in and build the tower in Canada, but
they've been itching to for a good while.
We did have the Trump Tower over there not too long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. The Americans are still, it's like all of this bitterness over 1812, like.
I will say it was a very satisfying day watching the Trump sign get taken down from the Trump Tower because I could see it from our office and
nice
watch that construction.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the CN Tower. It was originally built and owned by CN Railways, which is Canadian National. At the time, a lot of the freight rail, so Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, came through the downtown core because Union Station was down here. And it still is, but the freight rail no longer really come down into downtown. They do tend to bypass us with rail that surround the city instead.
Right. Okay. So is that what the roundhouse used to be?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So outside of the CN Tower, when you go up the CN Tower, then you can like look down on this thing with like train tracks that don't go anywhere. And now it's a Steam Whistle Brewery. And there's, what is it, like a Leon's, like a furniture store? No, the Leon's is gone.
It's now an arcade.
It's an arcade. It's just a weird area. Like it's, yeah, anyhow.
There's also a really nice little railroad museum there. And you can see all the old locomotives.
Yeah.
Retired train cars. It's really nice. I like that little museum.
It is. The museum is quite nice. And I like Steam Whistle Beer, but I just, it's such a bizarre area around the CN Tower. Cause it's like, it's kind of like they wanted to keep it like visually
historic, yeah.
But then like nothing about it except for this tiny little like hole in the wall museum, but it's like just
everything
weird,
else. Yeah, it's very modern.
Yeah, it's a bizarre little like tourist trap that just is, I don't know, it's incongruous is the word I was thinking.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, part of that is because a lot of that land was owned by the railway companies.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, when the project, the CN Tower project, was first proposed, they also wanted to develop a lot of this area here that we actually live in to be a housing for some of the workers.
Oh, nice.
That work. And they wanted it to be this big commercial residential development, which it did end up being, mm-hmm. but their proposed plans didn't go through because the city didn't allow them to zone it that way.
Right.
Eventually, it did all get built that way, but CN didn't get to profit from it.
Hmm. Well, there you go. Because, yeah, if somebody's going to be profiting off of, better not be the railways.
Yeah, I mean, 1970 is a little late for railways to be that kind of tycoon. I feel like that was maybe the 1870s.
Yeah.
So the CN Tower was originally owned by CN. It was transferred to Canada Lands, which is our Crown Corporation, in 1995.
Okay.
So the Crown Corporation technically, right. So technically the Queen owns it.
Interesting. I'm actually just, it's kind of dawning on me how weird it is that it's still called the CN Tower.
I know. As I was researching this to see why it was called the CN Tower, I realized how weird that we still call it that.
Yeah.
Everything else has changed, right?
Yeah.
Like the Sky Dome is no longer the Sky Dome. And no,
the Sky Dome is what? Rogers Centre. And the
Scotiabank Arena.
Scotiabank was Air Canada Centre, or it is now.
Yeah.
We live in a very corporate city. We live in a very corporate neighborhood in a very corporate city. Like Toronto is just...
But things get to be named after whoever bought them next. So like, it's not like we want to change the CN Tower or to be like the Queen Elizabeth Tower or anything. So
I know. The Jean Chrétien, 1995.
The Jean Chrétien Tower. That's awful. Nobody wants that.
I mean, Jean Chrétien might.
Anyway, CN Tower, this is what we've got. So the original purpose for the CN Tower was to be a large TV and radio telecommunication tower.
Mm.
Because in the 60s and the 70s, Toronto was building up so quickly with a lot of skyscrapers and tall buildings that the radio signal was not as strong as it could be.
Right. Okay.
It was starting to dwarf a lot of the telecommunication towers and affecting the signal. So the proposal was to build an ultra-high frequency UHF transmitter.
Yeah.
And that would reach somewhere just over 300 meters in height. And then on top of that, a very high frequency transmitter, the VHF.
Yeah.
Very technical term there, at 540 meters. So that's what that top bit that looks like just a lightning rod of the CN Tower is for the very high frequency transmitter.
Ah, I see. Well, it's a tall hat.
John thinks it's cheating that the top part of the tower that gives it that extra bit of height is just like a skinny bit. Like you can't go up it and it's not even concrete up there.
So I'm in a little bit of a mood today. We're on take two. I don't remember what I was talking about in this time versus the first time that we recorded this. So I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but it's like the tallest tower, like the part of the tower that you walk around is barely more than halfway up. And like the rest of it is just this skinny little pole, you know?
So, you know, the sky pod, that top observation tower is also partly in that section. Ugh. That part is higher. It is very high. It's a very tall tower, and it was built before we had computational modeling or calculators that would be able to model the more complex structures. Mm-hmm. We had calculators, but we didn't structural analysis that could be done by calculators. So a lot of the calculations were done manually. The designs were drafted manually by hand with pen and ink.
Yeah.
And slide rules.
Yeah. Both of my grandfather, they didn't work on the CN Tower, but both of my grandfathers had experience drafting with, you know, pen and ink and slide rules.
Yeah. So. It's really impressive considering it was the tallest tower of its time for quite a long time. There was no precedent for the type of structure that they were building. And it was all done by manpower.
Human power.
Human power. That's right. Well, I mean, I looked into some of the history. There weren't any female engineers working on this that I could tell.
Yeah. All right. Manpower.
Pure manpower. Researching this episode was actually super easy, which is great. I forgot how easy it was to look for information on structures that weren't built in a communist country.
Yeah, freedom of information.
Right.
And just like a general interest.
So that was really nice. I'm going to start from the ground up and talk about how it was built.
Okay.
So as a brief overview, the CN Tower is built up of 450 meters of concrete shaft. So the main body of it is concrete.
Yeah.
And it's got kind of like a Y cross section. So it's not round, but it's got a spine in the middle.
Okay.
And then it has three kind of stems that go outwards. And that's what the shaft cross section looks like a Y.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. I remember that.
Yep. Yeah. And then it also has, on top of that, 104 meters of steel antenna.
Yeah, so that's the thing that I'm talking about. 104 meters of just hat.
It's not just hat.
But they count it in the height, right? So it's like putting on a tall hat and saying that you're 8 feet tall.
And so the purpose of the steel hat...
I know, but still.
...is to allow for the transmission of signals, telecommunication signals. There's a main pod that's roughly halfway up, and it houses the UHF, the ultra-high frequency transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a sky pod, which is a higher observatory level, at 450 meters high. And on top of that, there's the VHF, the very high frequency transmitters.
Yes. And so ultra is higher than very, right?
No, apparently the very is higher than ultra.
Really?
Yeah, I don't understand it.
That's dumb.
Yeah. I feel like they maybe started with a name and then they needed like a name for a better frequency and they just couldn't think of anything.
They could just call it like the... just call it HF, higher frequency.
The super high, this is definitely the best frequency.
Yeah. MUHF, more ultra high frequency. So what is VHF and UHF?
They're frequency transmitters.
No, I know that, but so like what's going out over it? Because I remember on like old TVs, you had like a VHF, UHF thing. So is it like television signals or like does it do radio as well?
Yes, it's television and radio.
Okay.
And it's still operational. So right now it transmits for 16 TV and radio channels.
Wow. I didn't know that we still had TV going out over the air.
That's what I found.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh.
I mean, to be fair, and we're kind of skipping a little bit, but the telecommunication part of the tower accounts for only 1% of its revenue at this point.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So it's important, but it's kind of like, you know, how the Eiffel Tower was originally a telecommunication tower.
Yeah.
Well.
In its own cute little way.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's not why it was built. I mean, that's why it was built, but that's not why it's great.
Yeah, that's why it got approved. That's why the funding got approved.
That's not why you go to visit it.
Yeah, exactly.
Starting from the bottom, the foundation of the CN Tower, because the shaft is Y-shaped, so kind of like a three-pointed star.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The foundation itself is also Y-shaped.
Okay.
It is 5.5 meters thick of reinforced concrete.
Nice.
And it sits on solid bedrock.
Which is, it's pretty close to the lake, so that's decent if you can get solid bedrock, right?
Exactly, yeah. It needs to be on solid bedrock because it's supporting so much weight.
Yeah.
And in Ontario, the bedrock is not that far down, which is sort of nice.
Okay, that's good.
So the foundation itself, if you can imagine, it's not actually squared. It's got tapered edges. Because if you can think of this very square piece of concrete, heavy concrete that's supporting something even heavier, if it was just pressed directly down onto the ground, it would impose shear stress. So shear stress is when, like, shearing means to literally almost like cut something through, like a knife.
Yeah.
So you've got bending moments. So bending stress is when you kind of twist, right? Something can fail if it twists and bends, but something can also fail if it shears. So those are the two kind of loading types that can cause something to fail. So very simply, think of it like a nail, right? A nail that you screw into a wall. If you hang something really heavy on it, the two ways that it can fall off is if it bends, right? Then it can no longer hold its shape and your thing would fall off, or it would shear, which means your nail literally looks like it's been cut in half.
Yeah.
So that's shearing stress.
Cool. Okay.
So when I talk about the foundation imposing shearing stress on the ground, it's basically, threatening to saw itself down into the bedrock.
Weird.
So to reduce some of the shearing stress, they tapered off the edges of the foundation so that it's not exactly square, which means that the load can spread kind of like a triangle into the ground rather than directly down.
Straight. Okay, curious. I think I understand.
Okay.
Yeah.
So by doing this, we're making sure that the layers of shale that makes up the bedrock, that is the Canadian Shield and what we have in Ontario, won't fracture or crack.
Right. Got to protect the Canadian Shield from a tower.
This will spread the load more horizontally instead of directly down. The reinforced concrete, it's also installed under the water table because, like you mentioned, we're very close to the lake. The lake is definitely above bedrock. So the concrete itself is pretty much inundated with water mm-hmm. on all sides, the foundation. So it's really important that the concrete does not crack, because if the foundation cracks, then it can be really susceptible to water damage, and the steel reinforcements inside would be corroded.
Okay, interesting.
So how do they do this? How do we prevent concrete from cracking? Do you understand why we reinforce concrete?
Yes, because concrete, as it sets, it becomes very brittle.
Yeah.
Right? And then when you have a lot of moisture coming out as concrete sets, no.
I appreciate that you try.
Yeah.
Concrete is very good under compressive stress. So if you try to crush concrete, it's very strong. But concrete is not good at being pulled or being bent.
Okay.
So a concrete beam or anything that's like resisting load horizontally across it, if you imagine a concrete beam like a popsicle stick being supported on either side.
Okay.
If you press down on that popsicle stick, the top of the popsicle stick is kind of getting scrunched in, right? But the bottom of the popsicle stick is what cracks first, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's the bottom that's bending the most.
Yeah.
And the bottom is under tensile stress because it's being pulled.
Right. Okay.
That's why it cracks.
Yeah.
So concrete is not good at being pulled. It's very good at being compressed, which is what's happening at the top side when you push down on it.
Yeah.
And on the bottom side, it wants to crack.
Gotcha.
So what we do is we reinforce the bottom parts with steel, because steel is very good at bending.
Right.
And this holds the concrete together on the tensile part. So the part that's bending.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yep.
So typically in a normal concrete beam, even if you reinforce it, the part that usually is under tensile stress will still want to crack. But the cracks are okay because inside it's being held together by the reinforcements.
Okay.
So when you see cracks kind of under a bridge, for example,
yeah,
you see the cracks, you can almost see the reinforcements. It's generally acceptable to a point. So some cracking is expected.
Yeah.
But in the CN Tower, because the foundation is under the water table, we actually can't afford to have any cracks at all.
Wow. So it seems like maybe concrete wasn't the best.
Well.
It just seems... Anyhow.
What else do you build a foundation out of, right? It is very good at holding stress, like pressed down.
Yeah.
Right? So it's good under crushing loads.
Okay.
So to make sure that the bottom of the foundation does not crack, what they did is they installed pre-stress cables.
Okay.
Into the bottom of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So what are pre-stress cables? Instead of just laying down steel reinforcements in the concrete and then pouring it, right? That's typically how you would do it. You would lay down your reinforcements. You kind of see it in construction sites. There'll be these cages of the rods, and then they would pour the concrete around it.
Yep.
Instead of doing that, you're actually going to stress the cables. So you're going to pull them.
Mm-hmm.
And like a rubber band, when you pull them, it makes it tighter, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you pull the cables, you pre-stress it, and then you pour the concrete. Then when you let go, the cable is already stressed within the concrete and it wants to shrink. And in that way, it actually pulls the concrete inward so that when you press down on it to apply the stress, it evens out. Does that make sense?
So you pull the cable tight.
Yeah.
And then the cable is going to shrink a little bit because it's tight.
So you're pulling the cable outward, right?
Yeah.
You pour the concrete, then you let go. Now the cable wants to shrink back in. And when it wants to shrink back in, it's pulling the concrete around it inward.
Okay, I get it. I was thinking in terms of like the diameter.
Yeah. No, think of it as the length.
The length. Okay.
The length of the cable, it's pulling the concrete inward.
Yep.
And so then the concrete actually, you can't visibly see it, but it actually flexes a little bit.
Okay.
So that when you put your load on top of it, it evens out.
Gotcha.
And now the concrete won't want to crack on the bottom because it's got the cable pulling it in.
Yep.
And the load from the top pushing it down.
Perfect. That's beautiful. It's elegant. I love it.
Makes sense?
Yeah, I get it. I was just thinking of the wrong, but I was thinking about it. I was just thinking of the wrong measurement.
Yeah. Post-tensioning and pre-tensioning cables in concrete construction is a really good way of increasing the strength of concrete. But it's also really important that you make sure you apply it in the right way. So a colleague of mine has presented, and he was a super senior structural engineer, and he used pre-stressed cables in the construction of a vertical building, right? Mm-hmm. A concrete building. And it was going to be under a lot of horizontal stress from winds and whatnot.
Okay.
And so there was a central shaft that was made of concrete.
Okay.
And that was the core of the building. And he used pre-stressed cables in the concrete that attached all the other floors to it.
Okay.
And it would hold the floors up, right? Because now your floors can actually be more freestanding with less supports in the middle because it's being pulled inwards towards this central shaft.
Yeah.
What he didn't account for was that it literally pulled the sides of the building inwards towards the shaft, and it began to lean.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
You can think of what you can do with the concrete to give it more strength and to let it resist certain elements. But if you always think of the ultimate case that you're designing for, then you can sometimes forget your normal case circumstance.
Yeah, that's a pretty high risk.
He caught it during construction. They fixed it. It's fine.
Oh, good.
Anyway.
Yeah, I guess if they hadn't caught that, it would have been your former colleague.
Right. The foundation built with concrete, with pre-stressed cables. It is also hollow.
Okay.
Because they wanted to make sure that when concrete cures, it can build up a lot of heat.
Yep.
Because it's an exothermic reaction,
yep.
Actually, concrete curing. So they didn't want that buildup of heat to cause the concrete to crack, because when you pour concrete and when you cure concrete, like, it's very sensitive to temperature. So if you don't pour and cure at the right temperature, it can be susceptible to cracking.
Mm-hmm.
So part of that is to actually make it hollow in the middle. It'll allow the air to actually absorb some of the heat.
Gotcha.
Rather than it just being this like heat sink.
Yeah.
Having a hollow foundation also allows the workers to go in there afterwards and do more post-tensioning of the cables.
Okay.
Ultimately, the foundation is made up of 7,000 cubic meters of concrete.
Nice.
And 453 tons of steel.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I would have expected more, actually. Steel's pretty heavy.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot of steel.
It is. It is a lot of steel. I, you know.
It's hollow.
Yeah.
The thing is hollow, right?
It
so
is.
You're not just crisscrossing the whole thing with steel.
That's true.
So now we'll move on to the shaft. So the shaft has three elevator shafts between
yeah.
each of the legs of the Y.
Mm-hmm.
The diameter of the outer legs, like if you were to draw a circle around the Y.
Yeah.
At the base is 54 meters
okay.
round.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you go up, it of course tapers in and gets skinnier,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a straight triangle up. So it's curved.
Yeah, yeah. It has a little bit of a...
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that curvature is actually calculated, and it's more or less based on an inverted icicle.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's calculated because you can actually use that calculation for just about any tower. It's going to be more economical than a straight prism. It's going to stand easier because it's not going to buckle under its own weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an elegant design based on nature.
Nice.
It's always nice.
Well, there you go.
And the shaft was built with slip form construction. Because it's concrete and it's poured in place, slip form, so like the formwork to pour your concrete into, was constructed so that it could be moved up and then pour and then move up and pour and move up and pour. So this Y cross section.
Yeah.
You basically, they had to build a mold.
Yeah.
Right? So a mold out of timber mostly.
Wow.
And then pour the concrete. It also had to be adjustable because, like I said, the structure tapers, right? So it's a prism. So they had to pour it and then adjust the edges and then lift it, move it up, pour it, lift it, adjust it, pour it, lift it, adjust it, pour it.
Yeah. That's pretty intense. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really interesting if you watch some of the videos of how they built that. And as it was moved upward, you would also add the steel reinforcements into the shaft, pour the concrete. There was a crane in the middle of the Y that would basically lift the materials as the tower was being built, and it would itself then be lifted.
Nice.
Yeah, the whole thing basically built itself up. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's like, you know, building the tower while you are the tower.
That's it. Exactly.
I wonder what that crane is doing now.
They had to make sure it was done really, really flat, right? So the formwork had to be really level, because if it wasn't level, your tower is going to start to lean.
Yeah. Just like find out. Yeah.
So really complicated, especially at a time when we didn't have electronic equipment to keep things plumb. So you're literally like manually plumbing things. A plumb is like a heavy thing that you hang on the end of a string.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's vertical, then you know your thing is plumb.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Your thing is level.
Yeah, plumb bob.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So they were doing things with like levels and manual tools.
Jeez.
And they did this for 480 meters of the shaft. And at the top, they found they were only 28 millimeters off from straight.
Oh, good.
That's a 0.01% vertical deviation.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
That is. It is. But is it one of those things that, like, at that height, like, there's a lot of things, if you're, like, making a jet engine or, like, anything like that, like, a little bit of a deviation like that could be a big deal. So that's, like, in the context of this tower, that's real good?
Yeah, well, like I said, 0.01%.
Yeah.
So that's 0.0001.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Meter for every meter of height.
Nice.
Yeah, it is really impressive.
Cool.
Especially for its time, especially for the tools that we're working with. The tower is designed for wind speeds up to 418 kilometers per hour.
Nice.
Over its entire length of the shaft. And that is higher than any wind speed that's ever been recorded on Earth. And I did look up what is the highest winds, which is 1996, a tropical storm hit Australia with winds of 408 kilometers per hour. So we designed for 10 kilometers per hour more than that.
Nice. Well, that's good.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't think we're ever going to get that kind of winds because we're not on the coast.
Nope.
We're on a lake.
We are.
We don't get tropical storms.
Like, we're basically, it would be a pretty weird day. If we got a tropical storm in Toronto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but it is designed for that. And the wind action and the response was actually studied for 6 years prior to construction at the University of Western Ontario.
Oh, nice.
The results of that study also led to the design of two passive mass dampers inside the steel antenna. So the dampers, they're kind of like the inside of a grandfather clock. They just kind of sway to counterbalance the sway and the movement of the tower.
Nice.
They weren't really necessary, but it was just added as a safety redundancy because, like I said, they really, I'm not going to say they didn't know what they were doing, but they didn't have precedence of what could go wrong. So they just built in redundancies, which is what you do.
Yeah. I feel safer. I feel safer knowing that.
Good.
Yeah.
The top of the antenna can withstand sustained winds of 200 kilometers per hour and gusts of 320 kilometers an hour. The top of the antenna will sway as much as a meter under those conditions.
Wow. It's not very much.
No, it really isn't.
Yeah. I like it. All right. Tower, you've convinced me that it's, you know, well-designed.
So how did they make this shaft, the concrete part of the tower, withstand that kind of wind? Mm-hmm. More post-tension cables.
Oh, good.
More pre-stress cables.
Yeah.
So they use post-tensioning, which is, remember how I described pulling the cables and then pouring concrete?
Yeah.
This is actually putting in the cables and pulling it after you've poured the concrete.
Okay, and that doesn't crack the concrete?
No, so it's before your concrete has set. It's while it's curing and it's gained some of its strength, but not all of it. It hasn't completely bonded to the cables. Mm-hmm. And sometimes your cables aren't even directly in contact with, like the cables that you pull are not directly in contact with the concrete. It's within a conduit.
Nice.
So it's in a duct.
Yeah.
And that's how they did this. So they installed ducts within the shaft and then poured concrete around it and then fed cables through to pull it and then grouted everything in the middle so that it would all be solid.
Interesting.
You can imagine, as I was talking about before, they had to built the shaft gradually, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got the timber formwork. You got to adjust it, lift it, put in the reinforcements, put in the concrete conduits for the cables, then pour concrete, then lift it, do all that again, 480 meters.
Oh, man.
And vertical post-tensioning was a really new method at the time. Like when you're horizontal and a beam and a ground, it's really easy to control. When you're 480 meters up in the air and you've got one end of the cable in the foundation and one end like up in the air, it's really difficult to coordinate and synchronize that post tensioning because you also need to make sure that every single one of your cable is tensioned to the same amount, right? You don't want to have a deviation because then again, your tower is going to lean. Mm-hmm. And so they built in redundancies. They planned for extra cables to be in there, more than they thought they would need based on calculations. They added extra ducts in there for extra cables, which is everything they needed because the construction process of post-tensioning was not super great. When I say post-tensioning, they literally had machinery that would grab the cable and pull, and sometimes it would lose grip. And when you pull a cable by that much strength and then it slips from your grasp, where does it go? You lose it in the continent.
Yeah.
Right? So now it's somewhere lost in the 480 meters of tower that you've got.
You need like a really strong magnet or something like that.
So some of the cables got lost in the ducts. Some of them snapped before the full stress was applied.
Yeah. All right. So,
sometimes they couldn't even feed the cable through because the conduit was blocked by concrete because they were pouring concrete around and some pieces of concrete would fall into the ducts and block it up. So they had to drill through the ducts. Ultimately, there were enough cables installed.
Yeah.
For the strength of the tower.
Or so they say.
But there were a lot of mishaps.
Yeah. Oh, that's miserable.
So that is the shaft.
Cool.
The pod itself that you see, it houses the UHF, the ultra high frequency transmitter. And that is located at the bottom of the tower. And it's surrounded by a Teflon coated fiberglass fabric that's blown up to protect it from the elements. So it's not surrounded by glass. It's not surrounded by anything else. It's surrounded by a thin fabric so that it wouldn't interfere with the radio waves. Mm-hmm. It's very thin. And if you actually look up at the CN Tower, you'll see it. It's the part that the pod sits on that looks like a floaty because it's inflated.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's like a tube.
Yeah.
So that's what houses the transmitter, and it's called the radome because it's rayon material, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or is it just because of all of the ultra high frequency rays?
Yeah, maybe.
Emanating.
I really don't know.
No, I don't know. It doesn't matter, really, at the end of the day.
So when you see that white floaty bit, that's where the transmitters are.
Yeah. We'll try and find a photo of that one for you, for your benefit.
And then above that, there's obviously some of the observation decks.
Yep.
One of the observation decks, we've got the glass floor.
Yep.
So you can stand on that and look directly down. From that point, you're about 342 meters high from the ground.
Okay.
And that glass floor, I mean, I can give you lots of numbers. It can support like 11 hippos or 35 moose. It's always more Canadian to measure in moose.
Yeah.
I don't know how you get 35 moose up to that floor.
Well, it's unlikely. Yeah, it's unlikely that you ever would. And so you can't hold them accountable if you get 30, if you get 31 moose on there and then all of a sudden.
I just question how they tested this.
Yeah.
No. Theoretically, it could support the weight of 35 moose, so I wouldn't be too worried. I have jumped on that glass floor before, and yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I've stood on the glass floor. I've not jumped because I feel like it's not that I'm worried that it's actually going to break, but it's just one of those, like, what do you stand to gain by jumping, right? And then you go, and so then let's just say that you were the unluckiest person, and you jump, and that glass breaks. And then what? You're falling for like 400 meters. You've got plenty of time just to think, well, I don't know what I expect. Like, you know?
This is John's internal dialogue as he falls to his death.
Yeah. Ugh, great. Like, this is nobody's fault but my own. You know?
No, this is the engineer's fault if you fall through the glass.
The engineers aren't there saying, jump on the glass. Come on, you pansy, jump on the glass. It was like, no, it's not the engineers saying
it
that.
It is definitely
that's your
the
idiot
engineers
friends
fault.
Saying that. Jump. Oh, God. So I'll stand on the glass, but I'm not going to jump because I know it won't happen. But if it does happen, I'd be like, I deserve this.
All right. Within the pod is also a rotating restaurant, which I know it's a tourist trap. But here is a tip. On a busy, high tourist season day, right?
Mm-hmm.
On a beautiful summer day where there's no COVID-19 and no quarantine, it can take hours to get into the CN Tower.
Yeah.
And how do you bypass that? You make a reservation at the rotating restaurant, you bypass all the lines, and you get a private elevator up to that restaurant. You get a beautiful meal, and you can do a full rotation of the tower, see every corner of Toronto in 72 minutes.
Yeah. And also, it's one of those things like the food is good.
It is.
You know, it's you would pay more than you would for a comparable meal at a different restaurant.
But it includes your admission up the tower.
It includes your admission, yeah. It's expensive, but it's not like a ripoff.
Yeah.
You know,
we've done it a few times when we have visitors in Toronto, and that is actually the way to see the CN Tower.
Yeah.
Ultimately, with lunch, I think it's cheaper.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But at any rate, it is nice. And sometimes I get lucky. Like there was the one time we went up with my parents and there was an air show.
Yeah, that was magical.
Yeah. So we're like sitting up at the top of the CN Tower watching these airplanes like do stunts over the lake. Little things like that. You can't bank on that sort of thing, but like it does happen.
So there's your local tip.
Yep.
So the pod itself sits on 12 brackets.
Okay.
So what are the brackets? Imagine a wall shelf. You know, when you have a wall shelf underneath, you're supported by brackets.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, like an IKEA wall shelf. There's 12 of them that extend out from the shaft.
Okay.
And the pod sits on that. So there's a concrete floor that sits on that.
Yep.
And then outside of that floor that's directly in contact with the brackets is another kind of like a collar, like a concrete collar that just pulls it all inward. So it pulls the brackets in, kind of like the strap on a barrel.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And that makes sure that the brackets don't kind of like lean outwards, you know, like a wall shelf that you've had a long time.
Yeah.
The wall brackets will tend to sag.
Yeah.
So what this does is the collar keeps it all in.
Oh, nice.
How does the collar work? Well, it's post-tensioned cables in concrete.
Oh, man, oh, man. Post-tension, pre-tension, I can't keep up.
But this one's actually quite interesting because it's not straight, right? Because it's a round disc that surrounds the shaft. So the cables are laid 180 degrees around the ring, and there's 12 of them, and they overlap each other.
Nice.
And they all are tensioned inwards.
Yeah.
So they were laid and then cast and then pulled in towards the middle. So then the whole thing is tensed towards the middle.
Yeah. Okay.
To complete that effect.
Yeah. Perfect.
And all of that had to be form worked. So they built a giant timber formwork for the 12 brackets, lifted it 480 meters up.
Yep.
Poured the concrete.
Oh, geez.
Lifted a bigger formwork for the floor.
Yeah.
Poured the concrete. And that became the working platform for that part of the tower and up.
Nice.
Which is good.
Yeah.
The rest of the pod is built on steel frame.
Yeah.
And it's actually really crazy. So like iron workers and steel workers in the 70s in Toronto were fearless. Like if you look at some of the photos or even if you read Michael Adonchie's book.
Didn't.
About In the Skin of a Lion?
Skin of a Lion, Tooth of a Lion, something like that.
Yeah. He talks about just these steel workers that would be walking on the steel frame with no fall protection. And they would walk, right? We're 480 meters up in the air and they needed to get from one side of the steel frame to the other. And they would just walk on it like a balance beam.
Mm-hmm.
Bananas.
It is. It is pretty crazy to think. But, you know, also not such a good idea. Because again, that's one of those ones where it's just like, put on your harness. I don't need a harness. Right? And then you're walking and a gust of wind catches you or whatever. And it's just like, oh, well, should have worn a harness.
We all know that John would never become a steel worker or a window cleaner or anything that has to do with heights because he would just think that you're asking for it. But that being said, there was no death resulting from falls in the construction of this.
Good. that is nice to hear. I did not say asking for it, right? There's a difference between tempting fate.
So moving up from the pod, the steel antenna on top is made up of stacked cans made of steel.
Okay.
The cans are kind of pentagon shape.
Okay.
And out of each side of the pentagon is a transmitter.
Yeah.
Poking out. So there's transmitter on all five sides pointing out and transmitting on all directions from the tower all the way up on each of the cans going to the top of the antenna.
Nice.
And then that's all surrounded by another fiberglass fabric thing. And that's what you see out there. When you look up at the tower, that kind of white envelope that surrounds the top of the antenna, that's all that fiberglass material blown up to be like a bubble.
Yep.
So that's what that is.
Cool.
The bottom can is 95 meters wide.
Mm-hmm.
The top can is 0.6 meters wide. So it tapers off
a lot.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
They ran into some construction issues by the time they got to that height and that time. They needed it to be done really quickly. And so the cans were actually placed by helicopter.
Oh, nice.
So there was a helicopter picking up a can, moving up to the top, and it was actually going faster than workers could functionally, like, secure the cans.
Yeah.
And so some of the cans were just kind of, like, roughly held in place by a few bolts temporarily.
Oh, geez.
Until the iron workers could get in and secure the rest of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for a while it was just kind of like stacking. What's that iPhone game where you're just like stacking fruit towers or something? What was it?
Oh, tower. You know? I don't remember. But yeah.
You know, you remember what I'm talking about? Yeah, it was kind of like that.
You're just
like stacking things on top. Right. And there is the dampers, like I mentioned before, to counterbalance the sway.
Yep.
And that's at the top of the antenna, and lightning rods at the top of the antenna as well, connected to copper wires all the way down through the tower into the foundation, into the ground, so that if lightning does strike, it goes through that copper wire directly into ground.
There you go.
Yep.
Stupid lightning rods.
The CN Tower does get hit by lightning on average 75 times a year.
Oh, that's not as much as I thought. I thought that it would have been like a lot more than that.
Really?
Yeah.
We don't get 75 thunderstorms in a year.
Well, no, but it's going to get hit multiple times. That's the point of a lightning rod, right?
It's true.
So.
It is designed to have an expected life of 300 years.
Cool.
Gone through 50 of those so far, so it's still young.
Yeah. That tower could very well outlive the human race.
I got a few fun stories here. So a close call story. Remember when I said the helicopters were lifting the cans?
Yeah.
For the antenna. It got caught on a crane removal when a crane was being removed from the pod and the boom froze and it kind of got caught. And they were trying to scramble to get it free because it was running out of fuel.
Oh, geez.
And with about 14 minutes to spare, they finally got it unsnagged.
Oh, good.
So nobody died.
Nobody died.
It was great. A little bit of drama.
Yeah.
And then the second really fun story that I want to share is...
Really fun.
Really fun story. You're going to think this is really fun.
Okay.
June 26, 1976 was the day that the CN Tower opened to the public.
Yeah.
The entire opening ceremony was based on height jokes.
Oh, nice.
So they basically invited a lot of tall people to light the tower for the first time, including Finance Minister Donald McDonald.
Donald McDonald. What?
Donald McDonald. He was 6'5" or 195 centimeters tall.
Oh, okay.
They invited stilt walkers.
Yeah.
They had two random tall people. One guy was a kitchen cabinet maker. He was 7 feet tall or 213 centimeters. And a woman named Paula Lishman, who was 6'3" or 190 centimeters. And even the Toronto Star sent their tallest reporter to cover the story. Huh. It was 6'4" or 192 centimeters.
Well, there you go.
Isn't that fun?
It is, yeah. That one is, that's a lot more fun than the helicopter almost running out of fuel.
No, I think this is great. Like, it's ceremony-based. Like, I'm sure short people were invited, too. Like, you could, just so you know, if you're short, you're allowed to go up the CN Tower.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not like you have to be this tall to ride. I thought that was pretty funny. How very Canadian.
It is. It is just, like, one of those.
Isn't that adorable?
Yeah.
I feel like there should be, like, an annual tall people convention at the CN Tower.
I don't think that we need that. I feel like tall people have enough advantages in society as is.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So in a normal year, without all these crazy travel restrictions, over 2 million people visit the CN Tower
nice.
In a year. Like I said, the telecommunication transmitters broadcast 16 TV and radio channels, and it counts for less than 1% of its revenue now.
Yeah.
Mostly from tourism and the restaurant. It is still the tallest freestanding structure in the Western Hemisphere. Don't know what the Western Hemisphere is. I know what the Northern and Southern is. The Western seems like an arbitrary political line, but okay.
Yeah. I think it's based on Britain. Don't quote me.
Of course it's based on Britain.
Yeah.
Of course. The CN Tower made its return on investment in 15 years, which is pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is built to withstand earthquakes of up to 8.5 on the Richter scale,
which I never expected
Toronto to ever experience.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah.
In 1995, it was declared one of the modern seven wonders of the world by the American Society of Civil Engineers.
Oh, nice.
Alongside the Panama Canal, the Channel Tunnel.
Nice.
The Empire State Building, the Itaipu Dam, and the Zuiderzee Works.
Hmm.
Actually, I want to do an episode on that in the future. So that's the tide works and the system of waterworks that they built in the Netherlands to hold back the water.
Oh, clever.
Mm-hmm. It is really fun to visit the CN Tower. As many times as we've done it and as sick of it as we are, every time our family and friends come to visit, it is great to be up there. On a clear day, you can see all the way to Niagara Falls and Buffalo.
Yeah. It is pretty cool. Like, I've been pretty down on the tower, but it is neat.
It's tall.
I'll give it that. I'll give it that. Even though a lot of it is just a pole, it's still tall.
Well, what does a pole have to do other than be tall? It is a symbol of Toronto. It is the six. It is, you know, iconic in Canada.
Yeah.
It is. And I think learning about it and the innovations and the people that worked on it, I'm a lot more impressed by it now, knowing how they built it.
Well, there you go.
Next time you look up at the CN Tower, you can look for the radome and the brackets, the 12 brackets that hold up the pod. You can see those are on the outside.
Yeah, you gotta get those brackets. Get those brackets in your life.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure some of the other engineers that listen to this podcast will surely look up next time.
Well, enjoy it.
And that is our homecoming episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please let us know. Reach out to us on our social media platforms. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Measured and Metric. We also have our website at
http://www.measuredandmetric.com.
Measuredandmetric.com. I'm so sorry. If you enjoyed this episode and if you enjoyed our podcast, we'd really appreciate if you would leave us a review on whatever podcast listening platform you're listening to us on. I'm sure John would also really appreciate hearing from you if you enjoyed the music that he produced for this episode. And extra thanks to Astronomic Audio, who edit and sound produce our...
Extra special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound production.
Of this episode. All of our episodes.
All of our episodes. Thank you very much.
Oh, gosh. We should not record on a late night.
It's 10.
Thank you so much for listening. And we've got some really exciting episodes lined up and planned for the future with hopefully some exciting guests.
Hopefully.
So stay tuned. And until then... always remember to measure in metric.